Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Laura Sol.
And Laura, this is an episode I haven't yet heard. Where are you?
I'm in Australia, which is why I'm a bit groggy. It's very early in the morning here. I got up especially to record the intro.
And I stayed up especially late. Don't glaze over that fact.
What time is it? Oh, it's 10 o'clock.
It's 10 o'clock where you are. I should be tucked up in bed.
I got up at 8 o'clock in the morning.
What are you doing in Australia?
I'm pretty much on holiday, really. But I thought that I would make use of the opportunity and do some work. And so I went and interviewed some Australian paleontologists in real life.
Australian paleocasting?
Yes,
Australian paleocasting. We've got a good, pretty good Australian following, so it's about time we gave back... to the subcontinent that has followed us thus. Yeah, I actually got a good bit of feedback from Caitlin Sim. I think that's how you pronounce your name. Sorry if it's not. Who said some pretty nice things about us on the internet. And we're going to say some nice things about you here now. So everyone, go to www.CaitlinSyme.com and you can read all about her PhD looking at taphonomy in vertebrates, I think it is. Yep, so dinosaur forensics PhD. Everyone check that out. You scratch our back, we'll promote you because it's nice like that. So whereabouts in Australia are you, Laura?
Right now, I'm in a place called Umina, which is on the central coast between Sydney and Newcastle. Newcastle's another big city in New South Wales. So it's about an hour north of Sydney. It's a pretty nice place. Mm. It's near the beach and it's very quiet and calm, good for relaxing. But yeah, I've been into Sydney quite a lot. And then I went on a mini holiday inside my holiday to Melbourne for a few days.
You have nested holidays.
Yeah, I do nested holidays now.
Russian dolls of holidays.
Uh-huh.
Nice.
Melbourne is a very cool city. And I think there's quite a few paleontologists in Melbourne as well, but I didn't have a chance to interview them, sadly. Maybe another time.
You were too busy holidaying.
Mm-hmm.
Holidaying yep. harder. Do you just relax more and more and more with each level of holiday you go down to?
Yeah.
Is it kind of like Inception?
It's exactly like
each
that.
Holiday gets a little bit longer, like the time goes slower because you're just relaxing more and more.
No, it does actually feel like,
or does it go the other way? Does it just go so quickly because you're having such a good time and time flies?
I think because I'm doing lots of different things, it seems like it's quite a long time. When I get back to England, it's like 35 degrees here, it's really hot, and then I'm going to get back to England in January. And it's going to be getting dark at 4:30, and it's going to be cold.
Yep.
I'm not looking forward to it.
Well, I've just been in Zurich, so it's a lot warmer here than it was there. And that was the Palace live stream. So I hope you all watched it. If you didn't, where were you? It was a pretty good event. Managed to actually do a pretty good job at streaming it, I think. My computer only crashed once, and I only forgot to record like a quarter of someone's talk, and other than that it seemed to be working all the time, so I'm pretty happy. So thanks to everyone who watched. I really enjoyed doing it.
Yeah, I'm a bit sad I missed Palace in real life.
Yeah, it was good. We had a very cliched annual meal, which was on top of a Swiss mountain covered in snow, and we had fondue up there.
That does sound, yeah, that is a cliche.
It's very over stereotypical.
Yeah.
And then we all had to walk down this, well, up and down this icy hill. I'll have to put a photo up somewhere. And you've never seen so many paleontologists falling over.
Is that not what happens on field trips? I thought that. It feels like field trips of paleontologists falling over.
It's what happened on generally on conference nights out, but it was made extra bad by the ice conditions and the incline of the slope that we all had to go down. So it was a pretty entertaining evening, it has to be said.
Sounds like fun.
And so, yeah, I only managed to go to the whole conference because I didn't go to work offshore. So I have until early next year off, which isn't too long, I suppose, is when this episode comes out. So, as per usual, if you're listening to this episode, I'm probably on an oil rig in Scotland. Or I might not be. We don't know yet. And that's my life, not knowing what I'm going to be doing next week.
The drama of your life.
But I have had a month at home. Saying that, I've had 6 months at home.
6 months.
Yeah, 6 months. I'd last went off on end of July, I think, start of August. So not
What,
quite.
offshore?
Yeah.
No, you didn't. You went like before Christmas. Not like, I thought it was like a couple of months ago.
No.
We had a whole
Ages ago.
conversation about you going offshore, like me and you and Joe. Was that long ago?
Probably.
Oh,
I haven't
God.
been for ages. I've had
I've
work
changed. I've
since me.
completely lost track of time.
Yeah. Well, think how I feel. I've just been chilling out here at home. And time really does fly then. It's like being retired.
When was my first episode?
You were. I don't
When
know.
you
I don't think
introduced
anyone
me,
knows. You just kind of turned up
I magically appeared.
and then did no work.
Oi.
Ooh.
I just did lots of work with this whole interview. You haven't even heard
Yeah,
it.
yeah. So tell us about this interview. Who did you get?
So I went to the University of New South Wales, which is one of the universities in Sydney, and talked to some paleontologists there. So this one is with Robin Beck, who he studied at Cambridge in the UK. He's from the UK, and then came over to Australia for his PhD. Then he spent some time in the States doing a postdoc, and now he's back here. So he's part of a big group of paleontologists who do research into marsupial evolution, and they have a particular field site that they all go out to called Riversleigh. So some really interesting stuff about how you use fossil information to find out lots of different things and how marsupials have evolved, that kind of stuff.
I know next to nothing about marsupials, and so I'm hoping this will be a pretty enlightening episode.
Yeah, well, I certainly learned a lot from him, so it was good fun.
Well, let us know if you learn a lot. It'd be great to hear from you all. So leave a comment, share on Facebook and Twitter, and let us know what you think.
I'm here with Dr. Robin Beck. Hi, Robin.
Hello.
He is a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of New South Wales. So, first of all, can you tell us a bit about yourself and how you got into paleontology research?
So I suspect I'm like a lot of people who work in paleontology. I was one of these geeky kids obsessed with dinosaurs, and I never really grew out of it, to be honest. I used to go to the Natural History Museum and enjoyed looking at all the exhibits. And then I went to the University of Cambridge and studied some of the vertebrate evolution courses. And I had some very good lecturers, people like Jenny Clack, who does stuff on early tetrapods, Adrian Friday, and I got really interested in it. And then I thought, you know, I want to do a PhD in this. I was particularly interested in mammals. Dinosaurs are a bit passe. Okay, they're big, but, you know, they're a bit of a cliche. Mammals are kind of interesting, and there seemed a lot of scope for doing some work. And at the time that I was interested, there weren't that many people in the UK who were offering PhDs or taking students on. So I sent a few speculative emails to people in the US and also in Australia, and I happened to get in contact with Mike Archer, who is the head of the Paleo Lab here at the University of New South Wales. And Mike is an exceptional paleontologist. He's also a huge enthusiast, and he sent me this great email saying, yeah, come to Australia, come and work on weird fossil marsupials. That was basically the gist of the PhD project he was talking about, weird fossil marsupials. And I thought, I can't turn this down. You know, this sounds great. I applied for some money from the Leave Hume Trust in the UK, and I got that. I was very lucky to get that. And so I had an interesting PhD project and some money, and I came to Australia and I had a great time, and it all kind of snowballed from there.
So now you've carried on doing research in Australia and you're focusing on marsupials at the moment, is that right?
Yeah, so I actually, when I finished my PhD, I actually had a postdoc for 2 years in the American Museum of Natural History, but again, that was working on marsupial evolution. So what I'm particularly interested in is phylogeny, that is to say, evolutionary relationships, so which sets of animals are more closely related to each other than others, and then what that tells us about things like how particular characters have evolved, particular features have evolved, when they evolved, how that relates to things like diversification and biogeography. And marsupials are a really interesting example of this, because they're kind of, I like to think of them as kind of a Goldilocks group of animals. So there's enough of them for them to be interesting. They're quite diverse, big range of body masses. If you look in the fossil record, you get even bigger ones. Whole different range of adaptations. You've got carnivorous forms, leaf-eating browsers, really unusual ones like kangaroos, these big hopping mammals, things like the Tasmanian devil, all these really cool animals. And yet, it's a small enough group that you can just about get your head around them. You don't have really extreme morphologies, things like placental mammals, the other major group of living mammals. You have whales, these aquatic mammals, which are very, very different. Or bats are the other example, you know, highly, highly derived. And to really work on bats, you have to be a bat specialist. To work on whales, you have to be a whale specialist. With marsupials, you can just about get your head around them, and they're interesting in that respect. The other one is very interesting about marsupials is where they occur. So we have lots and lots in Australia, and they're very diverse, and in fact, they're kind of the dominant terrestrial mammal group in Australia. There are a few groups in South America, and yet they don't really occur anywhere else. There's one species, the Virginia opossum, which occurs quite widespread in North America, but that's it. So you have Australia, South America, nowhere else in the world, and that immediately raises kind of interesting questions. You know, how did they get there? Did they originate there? And the fossil evidence suggests that they didn't. They actually evolved in the northern hemisphere. So that raises questions about how they got into the southern hemisphere. Why did they go extinct elsewhere? Why are they only really successful in Australia, less successful in South America? All these kind of interesting questions. And we have quite a good fossil record. And yet that fossil record is still sufficiently incomplete that it's worth going out and looking for more.
So you just mentioned that there are gaps in the record. How good is the fossil record of marsupials, and what can we really say about them based on that?
So we have the fossil record of marsupials or relatives of marsupials, things that are closer to marsupials than anything else. The oldest one we know is from China. It's called Cynodelphis. It's about 125 million years old. And we have quite a few fossils in the Northern Hemisphere from when the dinosaurs were around, the Mesozoic, particularly in North America. And there's no evidence of fossil marsupials anywhere in the Southern Hemisphere until after the dinosaurs go extinct. The fossil record in South America is quite good for marsupials after the dinosaurs go extinct, but it's mainly concentrated in the southern part, so Patagonia in Argentina. We don't know a lot about what's going on in the northern half of the continent. Interestingly, we have fossils from Antarctica of marsupials, one particular site on an island, Seymour Island, and they're about 45 million years old. There's nowhere else in Antarctica that we've been able to find fossils, and that's for obvious reasons, because most of it is covered by ice.
Yeah.
I was there in 2009 on an expedition to another island called Livingston Island to look to see if we could find more fossils, hopefully of mammals. Unfortunately, we were wiped out by a storm and had to be evacuated, which was quite exciting, and it just shows the difficulty of working in Antarctica.
Yeah.
Then if we move into Australia, the record is quite good from about 25 million years onwards. So here at UNSW, we work mainly at a site called Riversleigh. And Riversleigh is an astonishing place. It has these intact skulls and in some cases associated skeletons of marsupials and other mammals. It's a really astonishing resource. But what's interesting about Riversleigh is that it's kind of typically Australian. We have fossil koalas. We have fossil kangaroos. We have bandicoots there at Riversleigh. So all the origins of those groups must predate, and probably by quite a number of million years. But if we look in the fossil record in Australia, we have fossils of mammals that are around 100 million years old, and there are no marsupials. We do have things like monotremes and a few other weird groups, but based on that, marsupials almost certainly were not in Australia at that time. So we have this huge gap between 100 million years and 25 million years. 100 million years, no marsupials. 25 million years, characteristically Australian marsupials. Now, there's only one fossil site between those two, and that's called Tingamarra. It's near a town in Mergen, and it's basically a hole in the ground in a farmer's paddock. But that's 55 million years old, and there are fossil mammals from there, including the oldest Australian marsupials. But we have none of the modern groups, the characteristically modern groups there. We have very kind of primitive, unspecialized forms. And that's the site that I'm mainly working on, because it's this key, this little kind of glimmer of light in this otherwise huge 90 million year black hole. So anything we find there is really interesting. Tingamarra is also frustrating, though, because everything is very, very fragmentary. You're talking mainly isolated teeth. Compared to Riversleigh, it's a joke. You know, you're looking at, you know, if you're lucky, a partial jaw with a few teeth in. But there's enough there to just give some clues about exactly what's going on. And that's what my project is at the moment. And it's a really interesting one, and I'm really lucky to work on it.
So you have this, in some cases, patchy, but in some cases really good information about marsupial evolution from Australia. And then you've got the fossils from the other places. How much have you managed to piece together about their evolutionary history globally and the timings of different evolutionary divergences or when they moved to different land masses?
We can put broad limits on some of those things. So a really important series of sites in South America, the first one discovered was called Los Alamitos, and they're known as Alamitian sites. And now these are about 70-75 million years old in South America. And what's key about those is that there are no marsupials in there. No marsupials, no placentals. Now, if this is not bias, and it probably isn't because we're finding lots of these sites, this is probably a clue that marsupials had not reached South America by that time. So this kind of gives us a maximum about when they got into South America. Now, if you have a look from a geological perspective, to move from the northern hemisphere into the southern hemisphere, into what we call Gondwana, so South America, Antarctica, Australia, Africa probably split off before then, to move into Gondwana, the really only plausible route is from North America to South America. So if marsupials are not in South America at 70 to 75 million years, it's probably a reasonable assumption to make the case that they are not anywhere in Gondwana. So that's our maximum. Our minimum, the oldest marsupials anywhere in the southern hemisphere are from South America, and they're somewhere between about 60 and 64 million years old. So there we have a, 11 million year window for marsupials getting into South America. Now, was this a single wave, just some kind of lucky dispersal? Was it maybe some kind of rafting event, so similar to how lemurs or tenrecs probably got to Madagascar? We don't know, really. To know that, we really need to know exactly the relationship between North America and South America and the relationship between North American and South American marsupials. But that's information one. The second piece of information is when they got to Australia. And for that, Tingamarra becomes this key point as well. Now, Tingamarra has been radiometrically dated, so using isotope information, as 54.6 million years old. So that's the minimum of getting on into Australia. So beyond this kind of broad framework, though, there are lots and lots of questions. One of the things I'm interested in is exactly what the relationship is between South American and Australian marsupials. Was it a single dispersal? Were there multiple dispersals? And they might have been multiple from South America to Australia, or from South America to Australia, and from Australia to South America. Or have you got more of a kind of a continuous single fauna that basically stretches from South America across Antarctica and into Australia? Now, the genetic evidence seemed to suggest a single dispersal, because all the Australian marsupials form this really tight cluster, and all the South American ones, the living South American ones, are all outside that group. And that makes a nice, neat story. You know, some kind of lucky little waif marsupial somehow manages to get into Australia, radiates, and that's it. Nice and neat. The work I've been doing at Tingamarra is basically showing that that model is wrong. And the reason it's wrong is because we're only sampling the living species. We're not sampling all those extinct lineages. Now, one of the things at Tingamarra is a tiny little ankle bone. And I get very excited about ankle bones because they're actually really, really informative. And this ankle bone is clearly not from an Australian marsupial. It's from a type that only was previously known from South America. So when we work out the evolutionary relationships of this particular animal, it's clearly distantly related from Australian marsupials. So the single dispersal model that the geneticists suggested is definitely wrong. And this tiny little fossil that is basically half the size of a grain of rice and would fit quite happily kind of on your little fingernail has basically overthrown this idea. And that's what makes the fossil record still important. You can sequence all the DNA you want, but ultimately you're only sampling living animals or ones that are, you know, only a few tens of thousands of years old. You're basically missing most of the story.
So you're talking about using data from living species as well as fossil species, and obviously the kinds of data that you can get from those two things are very different. How do you go about actually incorporating them and making them coherent?
Yeah, I suffer from kind of genetics envy because the genome is, well, in humans it's about 9 billion base pairs, and each one of those DNA bases is potentially, simplifying, is potentially informative about evolutionary relationships. If a geneticist wants to build a tree, he can sequence a whole load of genes. He or she can sequence a whole load of genes and end up with a data set of, you know, hundreds of thousands of base pairs, hundreds of thousands of characters. It's a very powerful tool. As a paleontologist, as a morphologist, I work with morphology, with anatomy. If you try really, really hard and you study and you scratch your head and you hold up two bones in front of you and argue and read up, you may get a few hundred, you know, a few thousand if you try really extremely hard. So morphological data sets are inherently smaller. But it's clear that if you combine morphological and molecular data sets, they have their advantages and disadvantages. And in fact, morphology can actually interact with the molecular data and actually probably give you a more accurate phylogeny as a result. And obviously, you don't have DNA for fossils. So if you want to include fossils into your phylogeny, and you do want to do that, because it not only does it the information about the fossils, but it actually gives you more accurate ideas about how things like body mass have evolved or other characters have evolved. If you want to include fossils, then you have to use morphology. So a lot of the stuff I do is basically involve taking DNA. I don't sequence DNA myself. I go onto the computer and say, give me all the gene sequences for a particular taxon, and combine that with the morphology, which is mainly what I work on. and analyze that data in combination. Now, there are still lots of questions about the best way to do this, about whether you should use specific models of morphology to do it or not, which models you should use. But I'm confident that combining the two different types of data is the way forward.
So you've been talking about marsupial evolution and how it's been different from placental evolution, but presumably early on in the evolutionary history of mammals, those two groups were very similar to each other. What do we know about when or why or how they might have diverged from each other?
So the split, again, you know, using the fossil record is a way of giving us rough bounds about when things occur. The oldest fossil of a particular group is obviously a minimum date for when that group evolved. Unless we have a very good fossil record, it's quite difficult to put a hard upper limit on things. So the oldest, what we call metatherian, so that's basically, think of it as the marsupial side of the tree, is 125 million years old, this thing called Cynodelphis from China. Now, the oldest eutherian, so that's the placental side of the tree, until recently was a thing called Eomaia, which is also 125 million years old, and is actually from the same fossil site, Cynodelphis. But about 2 years ago, another fossil was described called Juramaia. Now, Juramaia is older, it's about 160 million years old. And that is probably a eutherian. Now, if it is a eutherian, then we can put a minimum on the split between the two at about 160 million years old. But if we look at the millions of years following that, during the age of dinosaurs, so from 160 through to 66 million years, eutherians and metatherians are really not that dissimilar. They have quite similar teeth. They're similar range of body masses. They're small. You know, most of them are only 100, 200 grams. And I think the really interesting point is that if you were to go into a time machine and travel back to, say, 70 million years ago to North America, and you looked at the mammal community there, about a third of them are metatherians and about a third of them are eutherians. And they're not noticeably more diverse. They're not noticeably different. And if you had to make a prediction about which is going to be still around or the relative successes of those in the future, I think it would be very difficult to make a call about it. Now, for some reason, if you look in the North American record, after the dinosaurs go extinct, metatherians seem to have taken a real hit, and they seem not to have rebounded in the same way that eutherians did. Now, is that due to some kind of inherent inferiority in metatherians, marsupials? And people have suggested that and linked it to things like the marsupial mode of reproduction. Or is this just kind of luck, the field of bullets view, that metatherians just took a bigger hit and they were slower to come back, and it's kind of a contingency. It's just one of those things. These are kind of interesting questions, and we've not really kind of figured them out.
It's my understanding that one theory that's been proposed is that when kind of European settlers have brought in placental mammals and they've become invasive species from elsewhere, occasionally marsupials that survive in similar ways or live in similar environments have died out. So I think one example is the thylacine, which is a marsupial wolf. The theory there or suggestion there was that did mean that this was evidence that placentals were kind of better or superior. Does that hold any weight?
I think there are a number of kind of issues involved with that. So by the time that Europeans arrived in Australia, we're talking about already a radically different ecosystem. You have the megafaunal extinction, so all the biggest marsupials, so things like Diprotodon, which is about the size of a rhino, things like Thylacoleo, the marsupial lion, had died out. And it would be interesting to see how well placentals would have done if they'd arrived at that time. You know, how well a dingo arrived before Europeans, but how well, say, foxes or cats would have done in an environment where you have Thylacoleo around to kind of bite their heads off or diprotodon to kind of stamp on. So the ecosystem was already radically different and was missing some very major members of its mammalian community. So other examples of this are cats and foxes are very successful in mainland Australia. But if the Thylacine and the Tasmanian devil had been present on the mainland, would they have become established as well? The case with the dingo is better supporting this idea of placental superiority in some cases, because the dingo is first known in Australia, I think, about 3,000 years ago, and that's pretty much about the time that the Thylacine goes extinct. Now, there's some debate, but I think the majority of the evidence suggests that there is a direct link between the arrival of the dingo and the extinction of the Thylacine. So there are probably cases where placentals genuinely can make marsupials go extinct. And this has certainly been in the case post-European colonization, with the arrival of things like foxes and cats. But there are other issues involved. So, for example, Australia is a relatively small landmass with relatively fewer species on it. You know, if marsupials were in a bigger landmass with more species, maybe they'd be less vulnerable. So there's all kinds of interesting interlocking questions. So I don't think it's as easy to say that placentals on paper are inherently superior. You know, that's a kind of almost like a Western-centric viewpoint, and it's important to question these kind of things and get some real hard data so we can say, you know, that we're not making it up.
As you mentioned, placental mammalian diversity is high compared to marsupial diversity. Do you think that is just a question of timing, or do you think there are strong evolutionary constraints on marsupials that aren't present in placental mammals?
Well, in terms of the sheer number of species, so there's probably about 350 species of marsupials. The number's going up because people keep on finding new ones, but it's probably not going to be more than 400, 500. And there's about 5,000 species of placental. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the number of species, I would say that that's probably an area effect, just because Australia is a smaller landmass. In terms of morphological diversity, sometimes called disparity, yeah, I think there are specific constraints on marsupials that don't apply with placentals. So, for example, there are no true hoofed marsupials, and that might be to do with the fact that when marsupials are first born, they have to crawl into the pouch, or most of them have to crawl into the pouch. That is probably a big constraint on what their forelimbs can do. So this might be why we don't have bats, for example. On the other hand, evolving flight, which is what placentals have true flying members, the bats, marsupials don't. Evolving flight seems to be really, really difficult. Really, really difficult. It only has occurred 3 times in vertebrates, so birds, pterosaurs, and bats, and once in invertebrates. So only 4 times in the entire history of life. So maybe there's an element of contingency in there. And maybe placentals got there first. If things had been different, if marsupials got there first, maybe they would have become a worldwide group of flying marsupials that just would have stopped the bats getting started. So there are these kind of issues that you need to take into account when trying to explain these historical patterns. When it comes to aquatic members, there are very, very few aquatic marsupials. There's one semi-aquatic form, lives in South America. It's called the water opossum, Yapok. It's not fully aquatic. In fact, it spends most of its time on land. That's it amongst living marsupials. There is a fossil marsupial metatherian called Didelphodon, which may have been semi-aquatic as well. But that's it. And there's an obvious explanation for that, in that if you have young in the pouch, they need to breathe, and diving under the water is a big constraint on that. So there may be actual genuine constraints due to things like reproductive mode that put limits on what marsupials can do. Conversely, it's a point that isn't really emphasized enough, is that there are marsupial kind of body forms or body plans that don't occur in placentals. So there is no real placental equivalent of a kangaroo. There's a hopping rodent called the spring hare, which I think is a couple of kilos, but nothing like, you know, a grey kangaroo or a red kangaroo, which can be, you know, 50 kilos plus. And if you look in the fossil record, you have giant kangaroos, things so-called stenurine kangaroos, which may have been up to 3 meters tall and probably hopped as well. So there are particular body forms or body plans that occur in marsupials that don't in placentals. Another example is a cute little animal called a honey possum, and that feeds exclusively on nectar. It's a terrestrial mammal that feeds exclusively on nectar and pollen of particular flowers. Now, there's no true placental equivalent. There are bats that fly, but there's no terrestrial equivalent of a honey possum. So that's another example of where you don't have complete overlap. And kind of unraveling the kind of impact of constraint versus contingency versus luck, all those kind of issues, is actually quite difficult.
You've obviously spent quite a lot of time trying to understand the evolutionary relationships. You've been talking about making phylogenies. What can knowing that tell you about, I guess, things like convergence or other evolutionary questions?
Basically, phylogenies tell us everything, or they're the kind of the groundwork, the foundation that we build on everything. So a simple example is that if we want to do any kind of stats, any kind of statistical analysis on living organisms, they're not independent data points. They have this underlying relationship. Some animals or some organisms are more closely related to each other than others are. And if we don't take that into account, we can actually get misled. The only way you can distinguish convergence between close relationship is if you have a phylogeny. If you don't have a phylogeny, how do you tell? And phylogenies underpin basically all of our analysis of biogeography. For the biogeography I was talking about, you can only really work out what the biogeography is if you know where the different groups fit. You can only work out when things occur if you have a phylogeny with information about divergence time zone. And there are different ways of working out when that is. And if you have a time component on your phylogeny, you can look at really interesting things like rates of evolution. So, for example, did mammals suddenly start evolving super fast after the dinosaurs go extinct? Or they certainly got larger. Is this due to an increase in the rate of evolution? But these kind of questions all rely on phylogenies. So there's a probably the most overused quote in biology is nothing makes sense in biology except in the light of evolution, which is Dobzhansky. And then someone, and I can't remember who, but I mention it a lot in my lectures, nothing makes sense in evolution without a phylogeny. You know, without a phylogeny, it's just random facts. Phylogeny pulls it together, gives us this underlying framework on which we can start investigating interesting questions.
What can understanding marsupial phylogeny or evolution tell us about evolution generally, or maybe even just in other mammals, given that they're quite a unique group?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I mean, there are a few examples. So, for example, how have marsupials compared to other groups reacted to changes in climate or changes in environment? So if you look at the kind of global climate over the last 55 million years or 65 million years, there's a kind of a peak in temperature at about 60, 55 million years. And then the general trend has been down up until very recently when, as we know, things have started to go up again. So how has that affected marsupials? How does that compare with the pattern in placentals? So, and at particular periods in time, for example, the transition between the Eocene and the Oligocene, which is at 35 million years, he says, which is at 35 million years, there was clearly a big change in the mammal faunal community among placentals, most obviously in the Northern Hemisphere. It's called, the French name is La Grande Coupure. Did that occur in marsupials as well? Did they respond in the same way? And in fact, some South American colleagues of mine have suggested that that marsupials have basically declined in evolutionary success because they are more vulnerable to changes in temperature. That due to their life history, they're more vulnerable. It certainly puts limits on where they occur. So they don't tend to occur at very high latitudes, for example. So studying marsupials basically enables us to broaden our comparative set. You know, are we dealing with issues that are placental specific, or are they more widely occurring? And marsupials give us a really nice example, a nice kind of alternative experiment in mammalness that against which we can test some of our hypotheses.
So a lot of what you do is looking at these macroevolutionary questions. But do you also go out into the field and collect fossils yourself and work on them and describe those?
Yeah, I do field work in a couple of places. I go up to Riversleigh with the UNSW crowd, and we go up. We normally spend 2 weeks there, and it's quite fun. We sort of hit things with sledgehammers, which is hard work, and then blow things up with dynamite, which is a bit easier and a bit more spectacular. But we collect tons of limestone. It's just chock full of fossils that we then dissolve in weak acid, and that basically exposes these beautiful fossils. And I've worked on a few different groups from Riversleigh in collaboration with others. I also go up to Tingamarra, this key site. I keep on harking back to it, but it's kind of really interesting. And we were there not this year, but the year before, and we collected about 7 tons of clay, and it looks very unspectacular in bags. It's kind of a greenish-grey colour, and you can't really see anything in it until you wash it. And when you wash it, and you sieve it, and you sort it, then you find these little treasures, these little 55 million year old bits that are completely revolutionizing our understanding. Now, to really understand them and put them in context, yes, you need to do description, basic taxonomy. Is this a new species? Is this something that we've found already? You know, what are its diagnostic features? So yeah, I do kind of the basic alpha taxonomy as well as the bigger picture stuff. So I spend a lot of time looking at teeth. Lots and lots of time looking at teeth.
How much can you tell about an animal just from its teeth?
Well, this is the kind of question that only someone who doesn't work on fossil mammals will ask. Teeth are great, or particularly for mammals, they are great for a number of reasons. In an ideal world, given that you can't find complete skeletons, what's the fossil that you want? You'd want something that preserves really well, that is kind of very tightly conserved within a particular species, so you can tell whether something's species A or species B, because they're clearly different, and they're quite invariant within one species and different but invariant in another species. You'd want something that is complex, and you'd want something that gives us information about phylogeny, so evolutionary relationships, and also other things. So diet would be a great thing, things like body size as well. Now, teeth do all of those things. Particularly to the fact that mammals are warm-blooded, we maintain our own temperature, mammals such as ourselves. So mammals need to break their food down particularly well in the mouth. They can't be like a snake and swallow something and go and sit around for 6 months and slowly digest it. So mammals have these complicated teeth that break down food, and as a result they're these very complicated shapes. And the shape of the teeth is tightly correlated with diet, and it's also tightly correlated with phylogeny. And the size of them gives a very good idea about how big the animal is, and they're really well preserved. So we have everything. You know, obviously, in an ideal world, I'd like a beautiful, complete skeleton. I don't have that. But teeth are enough to kind of give enough insight to be able to say, hopefully, say something meaningful.
How long does this process take of kind of going and finding these fossils and characterizing them, incorporating them into a phylogeny, and then being able to use them as data to answer questions?
Ooh, that's kind of an interesting one. I don't kind of keep tabs on exactly how long I spend on doing particular stages. I think that the biggest kind of time, amount of time I spent doing anything is just learning about teeth, or getting to a stage where I can look at something and be fairly certain that I know what it is. And even then, I'm still learning. You know, there's still a lot of groups that I don't know a huge amount about. Not particularly familiar with a lot of placental groups, for example. I'm not too bad on most of the marsupials. So actually getting that background knowledge, that kind of underlying knowledge, that's taken lots and lots of time. And, I've been working on that continuously since I started my PhD back in 2005, and I'm still learning. So basic description, if it's only, a few teeth, that doesn't take too long, provided you have in your mind the comparative set and what differences are important and what you really need to focus on. A couple of weeks, maybe, I don't know, maybe less. To collect phylogenies or to collect phylogenetic data is actually quite time consuming, particularly because what I like to do is I like to look at, where possible, multiple specimens of a single species, because there is variation. We're physically quite different, I think. So you can't just go off scoring humans based on a single specimen. You can't go off a single specimen of a kangaroo, a Western Grey, for example. So that can actually be very, very time consuming. And I've been involved in a big project working on marsupial phylogeny with a colleague at the American Museum, Rob Voss. And we've collected a huge amount of phylogenetic data, and that's been very, very time-consuming. That's been several years' work. And then actual analyses, depending on how big your data set, can be really quick, or they can be really, really slow and take weeks sometimes if you're doing something really complicated.
And what to you are kind of the most important questions that we need to be focusing on answering right now associated with marsupial evolution?
I think, so a lot of these biogeographical questions, can we tie down, were there multiple dispersals from North America to South America? Is there back dispersals between the two groups? What exactly is the relationship between the South American and the Australian marsupials? There are lots and lots of fossil groups in South America that we just don't really know where they fit. So a lot of them have ridiculous names. So polydilopimorphians. What are polydilopimorphians? Where do they fit in the big phylogeny? Not really clear at the moment. Corolloamaginians, I can list a whole load of number ones. So, and then once we've got that kind of phylogenetic information, how has evolution in marsupials, how does that compare to placentals? What's been the effect of things like climate change and ecological change in the environment, the rise of grasslands, for example? There's this general trend, certainly in the last 5 million years, of things getting a lot larger. So this kind of megafaunal trend, and we see that in placentals and we see that in marsupials. But did this occur at the same time? Does it have the same drivers underlying it? And then a lot of the questions we touched on earlier, why did marsupials take a bigger hit at the mass extinction event? It'd be interesting to ask ourselves exactly what data would enable us to answer that question. That's something worth pondering, but these kind of big questions.
Do you think that to answer those kinds of things, it's a case of hoping that you find incredibly informative fossils and new fossil sites, or do you think we can make real headway with the data that we already have available to us?
I think that's a combination of the two. It's always kind of surprising to see, even in well-studied groups like mammals, how kind of understudied a lot of them are. So particularly the fossil groups, there are lots of fossil groups that have really not been studied in a huge amount of detail, certainly using kind of the modern techniques. There are things that maybe people worked on in the 19th century that have not really been looked at in the amount of detail that is required to get ideas of even basic questions like how many species there were and what kind of variation we can expect. So I think there is a role to be played in terms of looking at these existing data. There are millions of fossils in various collections. I'd like to go and see them all and find out more about them. Using modern techniques, so things like CT scanners to look at internal structures, for example, that can let you look at interesting things like brain size, for example, or inner ear structure. I had a student who was looking at inner ear structures of these fossils, something you couldn't do 20 years ago, but with CT scans you can do, and that enables you to tell interesting things about whether these things were in trees or on the ground. But with phylogeny in particular, I think that there is going to be a big role to be played by new fossils. So, for example, in placental mammals, we have a pretty good idea about how all the living groups relate to each other. But that kind of conflicts in certain areas quite strongly with what morphology seems to be telling us. So you may have heard of a group called Afrotheria. Now, this kind of Afrotheria really took off when I was an undergrad, which shows how old I am. And people weren't certain whether it was correct, because it seemed to group quite odd animals together. So it grouped things like elephants and sea cows and hyraxes, which everyone was happy belonged together, with aardvarks, which was a little bit weird, and then with little insectivorous things, Tenrex of golden moles, which was a complete shock. Now, the genetic data is so overwhelming supporting Afrotheria that everyone's happy that that genuinely is the real relationship. But then this means that there must be some very interesting fossils that document the early stages in the evolution of Afrotheria. So how can golden moles and elephants share a common ancestor? So to really understand that, I think looking at modern things or things we have in collections at the moment is just not going to be enough. We're going to have to go out and find more fossils, which is easier said than done. The same goes for marsupials. So as I said, in Australia, we have this gap. We've got nothing between 55 and 25 million years. And all we know is that these primitive forms are there at 55, but we don't have koalas, we don't have kangaroos. And then at 25 million years, we have stuff that is obviously kangaroo and obviously koala and is obviously bandicoot. So all those major fundamental steps in the evolution of these different groups have occurred somewhere between 55 and 25, and we have nothing. We don't have a single tooth from that time frame. So going out and finding stuff to fill in that gap is going to be absolutely crucial.
Great, thanks very much for that.
That's all right.
I guess just quickly before we finish up, you've got a lot of incredibly impressive looking pictures plastered all over your wall. Could you just tell us what those are?
So, as I said, I was at the American Museum for 2 years doing a postdoc with Rob Voss, and we're working on a big project on marsupial phylogeny, which is just about getting close to being finished. It's been a really mammoth piece of work. And we were also working with a molecular worker called Sharon Yancer at the University of Minnesota. And as part of this, we really want to do a really thorough treatment of morphology, of anatomy of marsupials. We're just looking at the skull and the teeth. Now, as part of that, we really want to document a lot of the variation that we see. Now, that's never really been done in sufficient detail. So as part of that, I was lucky enough to work with a very talented scientific artist called Pat Wynn, who, in collaboration with me, we basically drew, or she did. I have no artistic talent, but it was collaboration. I was telling her how to draw it, which is an easy job. But she drew these beautiful images of members of the different living families of marsupials. So up on the wall there, we've got the kangaroos in the top left. That's the thylacine in the bottom right. And this is an attempt to do really completely, hopefully 100% accurate drawings of the skulls of these animals that other researchers can use as a reference. So hopefully this will be one of the useful aspects of this study. We're also going to do a big phylogeny that people can then use to answer all kinds of biogeographic microevolutionary questions. I'm going to be using it for that anyway, so hopefully other people will as well. But yeah, the drawings, I'm kind of really happy with those, because as I say, I can't draw to save my life. So to have a very talented artist who I could interact with was a real pleasure and a privilege. And she's such a nice lady as well. So thanks to Pat.
All right, well, thank you very much for talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, I think that maybe I should have gotten a paleo artist for some of my reconstructions. I don't think that many of them are quite up to scratch.
Yeah, you should have done, Dave.
Oh, thanks.
No, yours are all right, aren't they? I don't really do that sort of thing. I don't have a paper with reconstructions in, but I'm sure that yours are a lot better than mine would be.
Yeah, I'm a terrible artist as well. I think that's something that me and Robin have in common. But this episode really surprised me of my own ignorance about marsupials, because I really thought that they were just an Australasia thing and that they originated there, that it was allopatric speciation, where they were just separated for so long that they just went on their own evolutionary pathway. I didn't know that they were all over the place and that Australia's and one in North America is the only place where you still get them.
Yeah, no, it is really interesting. I think I knew a little bit about some of that stuff from before because I've done a bit of research with mammals generally, which included marsupials. But they're really making headway with understanding the evolutionary history of the group. It's really interesting. Also, I found it really interesting to sort of talk to someone else who's very interested in methods stuff, so how you reconstruct evolutionary relationships and the kinds of things that you can test with those. So that was pretty cool for me, because that's the kind of thing that I'm interested in as well.
Mm-hmm. And it'd be great to hear a bit more about this Riversleigh formation. Sounds like you're going to be getting some pretty cool stuff out of there.
Yeah, so I actually talked to another paleontologist, Karen Black, who we will be doing a podcast with sometime in the near future. And she really spoke quite a lot about Riversleigh because she spends a lot of time there and has found all sorts of interesting things. So you can look forward to that one.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear it. So until then, it's goodbye from me.
And from me. Bye.
Bye. Yeah.
Bye. Maybe that's how you should say bye every time. Bye. Just squeak.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating and Laura Soule. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
Because she spends a lot of time there and has found all sorts of interesting things, so you can look forward to that one.
Well, that's kind of perfect. I think we should send you off on holiday more often.
Yeah, well, I would be totally fine with that. So
how about some Antarctic fossils, because there's quite a few down there. Do you fancy a little cruise down to the bottom of the planet?
Yeah, no, absolutely fine, send me there.
I've asked for a DVD for Christmas. Deep Freeze is, from what I've heard, a film about trilobites. Well, or trilobite, I should say, just one of them, I think, from an Arctic research lab or something, and they drilled too deep, and they have unleashed a killer trilobite. I found out about this at Zurich. me and David Legg, who's at Imperial, and Joe Wolf, who's at New York somewhere, we were talking about this film, and it just sounds like it'll be right up my street. Terrible B-movie.
Yeah, there were an alarmingly large number of terrible movies related to paleontology.
Well,
or geology.
Yeah, I want to do Paleocast Film Club. It'd be great to see if anyone would want that, where we get experts to provide an alternative commentary to paleo-related films.
That would be good.
Download and listen to during the film.
I would download that and listen to it.
Well, you'll be on it, so you have to.
I'll be on it.
Yeah, you don't get a choice in this. You're going to.
We're going to do the commentary.
No, well, you can be there, but okay. We'll get some experts.
Yeah, you definitely
need
experts. I don't
think anyone would be too interested in us watching films. But if we got Richard Forty to come and watch Deep Freeze, now that'd be worth listening to.
Yeah, that definitely.
And when you start thinking about it, there's so many great and terrible films that we could do. We could do Jurassic Park, could do the new Walking with Dinosaurs film, all things
Tremors.
Like that. Yeah, Tremors, Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah.
That creature is Devonian, I'll have you know.
Really?
Yeah, apparently so. Humanoid amphibian.
Mm.
And there's loads. There's just so many terrible B-movies. I've got one that... called Arachnoquake, which is about earthquakes with paleoed spiders in them coming out that shoot fire and drink
fire blood. Shooting fossil spiders.
Yeah, exactly. Excellent. We could get I don't know who's the lead paleoarachnologist, Jason Dunlop. Let's get him on and talk about the feasibility of fire shooting blood drinking paleo arachnids. If there's any films you want, audience, tweet them in. I need more excuses to watch terrible films.
I don't know. You seem to watch enough already.
I think I do. Hey, guys, I forgot to mention I got a cat. No, I don't want to talk about it anymore. No one cares about my cat. It's not even made any noise.
And she's not a fossil, so...
It's not a dead cat. It's a real cat.
Yep. It's a real life cat.
Let's just leave it as that. Let's have an enigmatic cat.
It's Schrodinger's cat. That's what you've got.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows? Is the cat alive? Is it dead?
Is it in a box?
It can just be both for now. Until you find out more.
Until she makes a noise.
No, it's silent. Who knows? Who knows? There's the end. Let's just do fart noises.
To finish the... Yeah.
There we go, that's more in line. That's more in line with all the other paleontology podcasts out there. There you go, guys.
Gosh. You can't, I'm not letting, you're not allowed to end on fart noises.
That's what the people want.
Respectable podcast, Dave.
Respectable, mishmactable.